I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. There's a roar out there for radical reform of an overgrown and discredited U.S. prison system, far and away the biggest in the world. On the right wing, Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner and the Koch brothers want to cut costs. On the left, in Harvard Yard last week, for example, the idea is roughly books in, prisoners out, or maybe just abolish prisons, if only to force alternative thinking about rejected people. The politicians can all look like bad guys now, going back to the Johnson-Nixon wars on crime, the Reagan, Bush, and Clinton wars on drugs, also the mandatory minimum sentencing, which brought us to 2 million Americans in lockdown on any given night, 70 million Americans with some sort of criminal record. But which of the reform notions out there command respect in principle or practice or politics? Khalil Gibran Muhammad gets us started. He's a scholar of crime and punishment and the bearer of an historic name and legacy in our epic of race. I asked him this week to cut through the fog of embarrassment around the sore subject of prisons.
There are a lot of people who, in hindsight, recognize that the scale of punishment in this country is unsustainable. It's morally bankrupt. It's not solving problems of harm that occur between individuals that happen in poor communities especially. And so there's a lot of people ready to do something about scaling back this massive problem.
Khalil Muhammad, I associate you with a book I admired hugely, The Condemnation of Blackness, short form, the bent social science that hung a criminal label on black people and culture and life, very different from early 20th century when white ethnic crime rates looked worrisome. And the response was schools, jobs, social supports. When the black crime rates got scary in the latter half of the century, it wasn't about poor people doing crime. It was about a dangerous race of people, tilting criminal. Or so the argument was. Are we still fighting that mindset?
I think we are. We certainly are fighting it in our political culture. We recognize in the most recent presidential election that ideas about law and order rooted in the stigmatization and old racism of African Americans or black people or more recently Mexican immigrants or Muslims is part of the fabric of America. It has evolved over many centuries, but it very much is baked into this society. And sometimes it's less malignant than others. And right now, I think it's metastasizing. So it very much has been part of how we think about who's a criminal, how do we punish people, how do we restore people who have been punished, say, with a prison term, back to their full citizenship and the full dignity of work and a place in society. So many of these questions have turned exactly on the racial identity of the people we're concerned about.
Meantime, on the, shall we say, hard right, Koch brothers, Jared Kushner, and others are saying we got to do something about this prison thing. I think they think we're spending too much money, but can they be allies or not?
I struggle with this, and I don't think I'm alone. I do think that there are colleagues of mine who have accepted that if there is a shared interest in scaling back punishment, then the Koch brothers are welcome to the table. They and their allies, and of course the money that is required to lead advocacy efforts and lobbying efforts. I will admit my ambivalence is because as a historian, reform movements often fail over the long run because the basic ideas that brought about the problem in the first place, in this case, racialized punishment, if that idea isn't attacked and if it's only about saving money, then it'll just show up again. It'll come in some other form. It will come as a kind of new politics of law and order, and someone will look at what we did today 50 years from now and said, they just didn't let the system stay the way it was long enough. We have to return back to that. So I think it's always a both and. We approach some of the practical questions and pragmatic solutions and make strange bedfellows. But if we don't deal with our racism in this country, its deeply entrenched roots, the way that Bryan Stevenson, the Alabama defense attorney and leader of Equal Justice Initiative, thinks about it, if we don't take his leadership seriously and the work of others committed to truth and reconciliation, then we're just going to see another form, as Michelle Alexander describes, a racial caste show up in the future.
In so many things you're saying, Khalil, you're reminding me of Malcolm X. Malcolm X, in the 1940s, changed his life in the Norfolk prison colony, which was, as you say, designed to look like a college campus.
Is it true that you have a prison record?
Definitely. I was in prison for 7 years. It was in prison that I first heard the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And I might add this, that the first year that I was in prison didn't rehabilitate me in any way, shape, or form. The prisons aren't set up to rehabilitate Negroes. They're set up to perpetuate the criminal tendencies of Negroes.
And part of the thing was his letters back and forth with Elijah Muhammad, your great-grandfather, and his immersion in Islam and in a public cause. What in the world can we do with that?
Well, what it shows you is the indomitable human spirit when left literally to be nurtured, to imagine, to live beyond the actual physical confinement of a cage. This is the amazing beauty of literature, of history, of appreciating all the world's cultures and picking and choosing how you see yourself in relationship to those cultures. Hmm. Malcolm X, like so many people today, if you spend time in community with the formerly incarcerated, you'll recognize that these people, when having a chance to actually invest in themselves, are some of the most brilliant, thoughtful social critics the world has ever produced. Right. And that's long been the case for any number of people stretching across hundreds of years. So it's not to say that we want to go to school in prison because we'll be the smartest people in the world. But it is to say that as long as there will be punishment in the world, as long as we will decide that some group of people will spend time confined and lose their liberty or liberté, then putting the power of the word in their hands to transport them to faraway places is one of the most radical things that we can do and should be doing if we want them to emerge in their fully blossomed way, in the way that Malcolm X did. I just want to say, as a matter of historical record, the period of rehabilitative program of which Norfolk is known for was part of an effort, a broader national effort, to transform white men in this country, many of whom were first-generation European immigrant men, into better citizens. And so you actually got, in the 1910s and 20s, these progressive interventions, which included education, included arts and entertainment like theater productions, mm-hmm. included newspapers where incarcerated people could write for themselves and to share the news of what was happening behind bars with others, including baseball teams and movie theaters were built inside of these facilities. Because the idea was to approximate what life on the outside was in a way that perhaps the overrepresented poor did not have full access to on the outside. Mm-hmm. We did away with so much of that by the 1970s, precisely because we decided that a new class of criminal coming into the criminal justice system that was blacker and browner didn't deserve these things. We didn't actually want to encourage them to see themselves as part of the system because somehow they disqualified themselves, that they were not supposed to participate, or the way that 19th century people thought about this, they were undeserving prisoners.
It was the 1980s before I went for the first time to Norfolk Prison and taught there in Malcolm's classrooms, an incredible experience. Black and white, there are any number of men in that prison with the articulation, the thoughtfulness, the reflectiveness, the humor, the education that distinguishes the people we're talking about. How do we, I don't know, restore, but maybe just sell that notion? These are some of the most interesting people I've ever met. And Harvard students we were talking with last week said they go humbly. They learn more than they teach on their expeditions into Norfolk and other Massachusetts prisons.
Well, I think that proximity, to use a very popular term these days, matters. So the degree to which we can create more intimate experiences between students like those at Harvard University and elsewhere for being in community with the incarcerated, the more likely we are to produce change agents, everyone from future elected officials to heads of corporations and, of course, lawyers and teachers, etc., who will recognize that life on the inside should be as much like life on the outside if we are to have a socially just world, if we are to live up to the democratic ideals of which we claim we are founded on.
I'm thinking of those Norfolk students. Some of them got Boston University degrees. Some of them were just immortal characters. The infamous Lefty Gilday, a white murderer. Saif Saibri, a sort of a modern Malcolm who became a Muslim. There's more to do with that experience. And now universities are talking about, including Harvard, reinstituting or broadening those programs. What's the hope? What should the curriculum be? What should be left to the independence of those minds in prison?
Well, I think the first thing is to recognize that a classical liberal arts education is the most transformative education that money can buy. Despite some of the increasing efforts to create new forms of vocational training for students.
Even in the big universities. I mean,
even classical
education is under siege.
Yeah. So we want to fight for that. We don't want to concede either for traditional students on the outside or for newer students on the inside. And in some ways, those newer students on the inside are much more open and already poised to appreciate a classical liberal arts education and the humanities more generally, because it's precisely these philosophical normative questions that shape the very worldview that they encounter when they are cage-like animals, when they are treated as a subspecies. You can't help but think about the very nature of the human condition under those circumstances. And so that's what we want to bring back into the university, and maybe they'll be the intellectual vanguard of the 21st century.
Khalil Gibran Muhammad teaches history, race, and policy at Harvard's Kennedy School. His big book is The Condemnation of Blackness, Race, Crime, and the Making of Modern Urban America. Coming up, decoding the cause of prison abolition with angles inside and out. This is Open Source. Our guest, Donna Murch, from Rutgers University, has written Carceral History in Slices. First book was on the rise of the Black Panther Party in Oakland. The work in progress for Donna Murch is about crack in Los Angeles, policing the crisis and the war on drugs. She's in a cluster of scholars spending a year comparing notes with each other at Harvard on crime and punishment over time. These waves are striking, Donna. I was just looking at photographs of the Norfolk prison in Massachusetts that Khalil Muhammad was just describing. From the 30s and 40s, Norfolk looked almost all white, like a quaint corporate picnic or something. I'm sure with people in the picture who'd done some horrific things. But I'm interested in your historical view, a 50-year arc on this story that preoccupies us.
Yeah, thank you so much for that. You know, in order to start the story of mass incarceration, that 50-year arc, I'm actually going to go back to the 1940s, because my own entry into studying mass incarceration actually came from studying the rise of the Black Power movement. And one of the great surprises is that when you look at the shifting demographics that happen during and after World War II, this is the period of the largest migration of African Americans in history. It's the largest population movement inside the United States. And it's the period in which the majority of African Americans move from the South to the North.
Right.
And one of the things
that We all love Isabel Wilkerson's book on it, The Warmth of Other Suns, a historic thing.
One of the things that greets them in the North is criminalization. And in the case of looking at California, which is one of the most generative and most important sites for the creation of new types of criminalization incarceration, it's seen very clearly. So the city that I was studying, Oakland, had a population of 2% in 1940, and then by 1981, it's over 50%. Mm. And what you begin to see in the 1940s and 1950s is essentially the criminalization of this first generation of migrant youth. So understanding how prisons and particularly youth authorities, in the case of California, it's the California Youth Authority, they begin to change starting in the 40s and 50s, but it's most visible in the 1960s. And part of this in the North, because these are different regional stories, the North, the South, the West, and the East, they all have slightly different stories of mass incarceration. But if you're talking about northern and western cities, as black populations migrate north seeking new opportunities, this was actually a part of the civil rights movement, leaving behind Jim Crow in the South and coming to the west and north, like the Stevie Wonder song Living for the City, which my book is named for. So, you know, that push to escape segregation, to seek opportunity, to seek jobs, and very importantly, to seek public education. What they're greeted with really is a story of the criminalization and especially criminalization of their own children. Mm-hmm. So that's where I would start the story.
May I say, people have wondered why the refugees from Jim Crow, in a sense, weren't greeted as victims of terrorism, as refugees from many other places have been. It was a migration that changed the culture of this country, sports and music and all kinds of language and roles. Set those two in relation, the victimization that was going on at the same time.
Well, it's important to think of white supremacy as a system that was nationwide. So you have a system of organized legal segregation in the South, but you have all deep forms of segregation in the North and jobs and housing. You know, this is what the period after 1965, the urban rebellions and the Black Power movement address, the political economy of race. So in that sense, the ways in which white populations fight against black people living next to them, most importantly, when we see the criminalization of children, having the desegregation of public schools, you know, people are greeted with house bombings and physical violence, the formation of essentially street organizations to keep out black children from settling. So, you know, what we learn about is that there was a northern civil rights movement and a lot of this fight takes place in the north. So I think there's a structural piece about criminalization. As large numbers of black people move out of the South, we begin to see an intensification. And, you know, I think there's often a conceit in history of a telos, that things always get better. But when you look at the Second Great Migration, you actually watch new forms of control, domination, and criminalization. And it's very, very clear in California. So you don't actually, unlike the South, the laws on the books in California were focused on Mexicans of Indian descent, because there's a long tradition of really a kind of, people call it Juan Crow. But in the 40s and 50s, in this large, you know, migration of black populations, you begin to see new mechanisms for the concentration and segregation in schools and housing and jobs. So that's where I would start my story. Now, if you want to talk about kind of talking about it from the point of view of the federal government, because I think that's important, this discussion of criminalization and incarceration happens at multiple levels of the state, at municipal, state, and federal. But thinking about the what we call mass incarceration, from the origins of the United States, we've always had disproportionate racial incarceration. When you go back and you study the colonial period, you see black people being incarcerated at numbers far larger than white people, especially migrants from the South. But it's in this period, I'd say, from the mid-70s through today that we refer to when we're talking about mass incarceration, this is where the numbers grow immensely. And so the question is, how does that happen? And one of the most important reasons it happens has to do with the beginning of state-level mandatory sentencing. It also with, as Elizabeth Hinton, who was one of the organizers of the Beyond the Gates conference, along with Garrett Felber, and her book From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime, as she argues very forcefully, that in 1965, when you have a declaration of a war on poverty, which was this very important moment in history, you also have simultaneously in 1965 the declaration of a war on crime. And in 1968, under Democratic administration under Johnson, just before he leaves office, he passes the Omnibus and Safe Streets Act. And this lays down a foundation for providing large amounts of federal monies that are essentially distributed through block grants to states, the overwhelming majority of which goes to prisons and to police. So you have a federal government that is providing an incentive structure for the expansion of prisons at the state level and the expansion of law enforcement. So this is when you begin to see the huge increase in numbers of laws of different kinds of criminalization and the expansion of police powers. I study California, which is very important in driving this. And in the 1970s, you see a war on gangs in which you begin to see the targeting of young people. In the 1980s, you have the development of new technologies of prosecution like gang injunctions that take things that are considered constitutionally protected rights, the right of assembly, the right of dress, the right of free speech, and they begin to criminalize it. And of course, the successive wars on drugs. So in 1970, Richard Nixon declares a war on drugs. He draws partially on power that are made possible by a Democratic administration. So that's something that I would say that's important for today, that mass incarceration was a bipartisan project. We often focus on Ronald Reagan and on Richard Nixon, but this is right. A long history that was really a consensus within the two-party system in the United States.
Right, and, including the Clintons and Hillary Clinton, who paid dearly in the campaign for all that super predator rhetoric in her earlier life. Let me just say, you mentioned Elizabeth Hinton's remarkable book, From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime. She makes the point that among the bad guys were the social scientists, and some of them at Harvard, including Pat Moynihan and Edward Banfield, who, I mean, rereading them now, they didn't know what to do with the race component of their numbers. And they tried, it would seem, to finesse it or to sort of euphemize it away. And, of course, the politicians knew exactly what they were doing. But do we want to – we have to revise a lot of that science, don't we?
We do. I think that, you know, it's 19 – today it's 2018, and we are 50 years since 1968. And I think that that anniversary matters because 1968 in many ways is symbolic. It's a synecdoche of a particular type of radical politics. And when you think about what's going on during the 1960s, you have a mass mobilization of African Americans that transforms the United States. You have the legal dismantling of Jim Crow in 10 years from 1955 to 1965. And then you have the explosion of urban rebellions throughout the 1960s. So I give that as social context for also understanding what the intellectuals are responding to. So you have Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who is notorious for the Moynihan Report, which provided a template for essentially the pathologization of black people by looking at relations of the family. So arguing that it was, he's famous for the matriarchy thesis, that going all the way back to slavery, that you had families in which women were disproportionately empowered, they stripped men of their manhood, and therefore men were incapable of being economically viable. So this idea is a constant, recurrent idea about black pathology, and it's used to really criminalize young people and to justify different kinds of systems of repression. So one of the things that Elizabeth's book argues is that we see this genealogy of these ideas of urban pathology that help to justify and naturalize a war on crime. Edward Banfield is the mentor at Harvard, is the mentor of James Wilson, who comes
James
up with
Q. Wilson.
James Q. Wilson, who comes up with the idea of the broken windows policing. And I think what I would say more generally about thinking about Harvard is that the Kennedy School is so important to the centers of power. You have a kind of policy school that influences both, of course, as we know, in the Vietnam War, played such a crucial role that people have talked about in terms of the best and the brightest. But I think you almost have an internal question about the best and the brightest, a parallelism about what happened with the Vietnam War, the surprise that you had Democratic intellectuals that helped to lay the basis, you know, for the mass slaughter in Vietnam. But they also did this in thinking about the response to the urban rebellions. And very importantly, these two things were connected to each other. When you think about the radical protest movements of the 1960s, like the Black Panther Party, they were actually bringing together an anti-colonial struggle in Vietnam and redefining the response to policing, violence, incarceration through that anti-colonial lens.
It's a dangerous blend of the two, I like to say, the two most powerful brand names in American life, certainly in this part of the world, Kennedy and Harvard, and they've done some things you'd love to take back. I want to introduce Kaya Stern. She is our model teacher in the prison system. She runs the Prison Studies Project, co-founded at the very same Harvard with the sociologist Bruce Western. Her book is Voices from American Prisons, Faith, Education, and Healing. At a moment when Elizabeth Hinton, the same Elizabeth Hinton, is advocating that we think of prisons as colleges and universities. They used to be schools for crime. They could be schools for something else. Explain your experience. You're an ordained minister, interfaith minister, Kaya, and you transformed yourself in fashion by prison teaching. How so?
Thank you. I would say, as a student, I first stepped into a maximum security prison in Stormville, New York. And I remember seeing a man cross my path. He had property of New York State written across his back. And the sunlight refracted off of the steel shackles around his ankles and temporarily blinded me. And the course of my life was altered. And for the last 25 years, I've been a student or teacher in prison. And I would say, you know, in your introduction as a model educator or teacher, it's as a student, my stance is as a student so much. I come and leave as a visitor. I would say that prisons in so many ways are a shameful environment. It's shameful to be present. It's shameful to walk away. And I learn most from the folks who are most intimately aware of the ways we punish in the United States. Yeah.
It's a humbling place. And the Harvard students who are doing some of that work now were saying to me the other night, of course, they learn much more than they teach. There's extraordinary wisdom in those prisons. It's a privilege to be there. And I'm there with you.
And I think to bring students who have immense privilege and resources together with students who, though education is a basic human right, it's systematically denied to people in jails and prisons across our country. So to bring people together who are denied opportunity and people who have immense opportunities to be in community in a different way, and that's transformative for everybody.
You see a little bit of everything. The violence in this country, poverty, addiction, race, public health, lack of it, needs for available mental health. I mean, how do you frame it?
Well, if we were to reimagine poverty, violence, mental illness, and addiction as a public health crisis, then our prison population would look very different. And you know, this idea of imagining prisons as universities, I think it's important to remind ourselves that the vast majority of people who are locked up have less than a ninth grade formal education, that the need for a continuum of education, for adult basic education, for English language learners, for helping people to pass the HISET in Massachusetts, the GED more broadly, and then to be college ready, and then to be thriving in classical liberal arts and humanities as of course, transformative education with poetry and politics and history and philosophy for sure. And so many people are struggling to be literate. And it's a tiny majority of people who are even at the post-secondary level.
What does it say that the great Dostoevsky, you know, maybe the world's greatest ever novelist, wrote one of his early books called House of the Dead about his own imprisonment in Siberia on political charges in the 1850s. And I think for a century it was his most popular book in Russia. I was told to read it before I ever went into prison. And I was so struck by his observation of men in confinement, men who've lost their freedom, what they share, what they don't share, what they like, what they don't like, and the hierarchy, even then, always puts the murderers at the top of the heap in a prison. It just fascinated me. I wanted to read it to the guys. I didn't tell them where it was from, and I copied it out so they wouldn't see it was in a book. And like, with one voice, they said, I know the guy who wrote that. He left here 6 weeks ago. Or somebody said, no, that was Malcolm's observation. No, I said somebody else. Somebody said it's Jack Abbott, the guy that Norman Mailer almost rehabilitated. And I said, no, this is a Russian, a writer in 1850 in Siberia. But that touches on, I think, something we forget. There's an eternal experience here, something very here and now about America, but something of all time about men who are missing their freedom. I think you've been to that space.
Yes, I'm hearing two things. I mean, the idea of being in prison to ourselves and this I think human experience that there are parts of ourselves that are alien to us and resonates and also want to attend to women and girls for a minute because they're the fastest growing segment of the prison population.
On what
right
charges?
Now. On what charges?
What are they being charged with? The flood of women and young women.
Well, it's to be specific. It's mostly black and brown women, girls and women who are being charged with a variety of crimes. I mean, the vast majority are being charged with what people call nonviolent drug offenses. But I would really be wary of this dichotomy of violent and nonviolent because I think in our efforts for reform, we imagine that some people can be forgotten. And no one can be forgotten in our efforts for reform.
I want to come back to this matter that Khalil mentioned about what these people in prison want to know. His case for a classical, liberal, humanistic, dare I say, old-fashioned education is what's indicated. We're talking about prisons with Kaya Stern and Donna Murch and Andrea James when we come back. Coming up, what the prison abolitionists are trying to tell us. This is Open Source. What might be done about prisons in the United States, about this carceral state within the system, within this country, that used to be known as the prison industrial complex? What's to do? Our guest, Andrea James, founded Families for Justice as Healing. She runs the National Council for Incarcerated and Formerly Incarcerated Women and Girls. She had an elite education and a law degree when she went to prison for 2 years on conviction for wire fraud in 2009. Andrea James, with personal experience behind bars, you call yourself a prison abolitionist to end the incarceration of women in particular. Just what do you mean by that? Well, we're not going to empty the prisons overnight, are we?
Well, we certainly could do a really great job of beginning to empty the prisons if we focused on shifting from a concentration on just making prisons better to actually putting resources into communities and taking listening to what people who have had the direct experience need in their lives to heal and transform their lives and their communities. We could actually, yes. When you look at who is currently incarcerated in this country, particularly when we look at the profile of incarcerated women, yes, we could actually empty our prisons in a much more timely manner than what we're doing, focusing mostly on reentry and lowering recidivism if we actually paid attention to what communities need to heal and advance based on the long and history of programs that have been matched along with law enforcement that have really pushed us further away from giving the resources to communities that they need so that we don't have this steady flow of poor people, particularly poor people of color, into prisons.
Can I say with respect that it seems to me there's a thought exercise here that's very valuable in just that word, abolition. It reminds me a little bit of the movie Black Panther as an exercise in thinking, what if there were an African nation that had never been touched by slaves, you know, the slave trade or colonialism or imperialism, what might it be like today? What might the country be like if there was not a raging drug problem or if social services and mental health services were adequate? Where would you begin? I mean, I think you can walk through a prison and say, this man does not need to be in prison. He does need dental care or emotional therapy or fellowship or family, but not here. Do you know what I'm talking about, Andrea? I mean,
Well, certainly. I mean, when you look at what Native and Aboriginal populations, how they govern themselves, how they create a community amongst themselves, it starts from exactly why we named our local organization Families for Justice as Healing. They started from a place of healing, not from a place of how do we cause further harm.
Right.
And when you start from a place of how do we begin to heal people, you start to by saying, taking the offense off of the table. And first telling people who they are, reminding them about who they are, reminding them about where they come from, reminding them about who's attached to them and how their actions have either caused harm or caused some sort of disruption within their community. Because it's about community. It's about building up people. It's not about talking about first and foremost an offense that could have happened. It could be situational. It could have been something that would never, ever happen again. It could have been something that was caused by things that aren't related necessarily to that person as an individual. And so it's really important when you talk about if we had this other utopia in place now, you're talking about going back to a way of governing folks that came from the community itself.
Andrea, as you speak, I wonder, how do other countries get over the punishment impulse, the humiliation impulse, the assert rank, assert domination impulse that runs rampant in our prisons?
Well, first of all, I mean, I can't really speak for other countries except to say that they're a lot more homogenous than we are here in the United States in many ways. So when you look at something that can be compared, such as Germany, for instance, which, you know, is on the same economic level that we're on, and it has a lot of the same political ideology that we have, and look at what they did after something as horrific as the Holocaust, and what great strides they went through, and then also took that step further to figure out what is a better way to handle offenses that are deemed crimes in their country. And they've come up with a very different model that, you know, far surpasses. We're in the dark ages when it comes to this issue. And mostly, you know, the majority of people, if they even get incarcerated, which is not the majority of people in Germany, but if you do end up with a period of incarceration, it for the most part, the majority of people serve less than 2 years. And then even for, you know, the very difficult offense of taking a person's life, there is a cap on the amount of time that you will do for that, because they keep at the forefront that people heal, people change. People provided the access to what they need in their lives do change, as opposed to looking at the system in the United States, where, first of all, right now, even as we tout this concept that is being held up by a lot of the conservative right-wing groups and a lot of the very wealthy organizations that are now at the center of criminal justice reform in this country, they're still talking just from the place of reentry and lowering recidivism. Nobody is having the conversation that gets us to the place of addressing what are the actual structural underlying factors that need to be addressed. We can decarcerate all we want, and we need to do it. But what happens if we don't do anything to stop the flow of people into prisons? And that's what we really need to shift our conversation around. And it, you know, we've talked this entire evening about the importance of education in prison.
I was going to say, that's the buzzword. What did you learn? What do the women you know in prison need to know? Practical stuff, philosophical stuff, imaginative stuff?
They need to know everything that everybody else needs to know. People in prison are still, they're no different than people who are outside of prison. And when they have access to information for everybody, I don't care who you are or where you are. If you have access to information and it is something that is of interest to you, it is going to pique your interest to learn more. That is the same for anybody who is incarcerated as it is for a Harvard student sitting in a classroom. And we don't provide that. Right now, for instance, in my city of Boston, Massachusetts, we just had a report that came out that just, you know, was just shocking, that a huge percentage of the public school education budget now is being redirected into charter schools. When we think about that, it's incredibly discouraging, because when a woman is on a prison bunk, her children are in public school. And when money is being redirected away from their opportunity to have full access to education like any other child with that kind of access receives now, that is very discouraging, because that says that the policies that are being adopted are not policies that are trying to redirect us away from the flow of our people into prisons. And it's not going to be, the solution cannot just lie in looking at decarceration and recidivism.
Andrea James, I'd like the other ladies to respond to that point you made, and Khalil Mohammed said it too. Very interesting to me, that when you've been on the inside long enough, you realize that they are exactly like the people who live on your street, almost all of them. I mean, there are some wild exceptions, but, you know, little flaws, great virtues, or vice versa, that they're ordinary people. Do we believe that?
Yes. I mean, I think Andrea's right on point. It's about access for people, people who are in prison, people with criminal records, people who are denied education, and this idea of justice as healing and justice in relationship, and the work that Andrea is doing to heal the harm in relationship, and then also to tend to structural injustice, to transforming structures. Because as it is now, to have somebody serving a triple life sentence, condemned to die in prison three times over for a crime they committed as a child, how do you restore what is not just to begin with?
Donna Murch, are you intrigued by this thought that they're no different from you and me, the people we work with, the people we...
But, you know, to be honest, I think that we have to think about who the normative subject is. I have people in my family who are in prison. I know they're the same, you know? I mean, I think that's actually a very common experience for many people in the United States. What I would do is invert the question and talk about the process of othering. So I'd say, yes, of course. Mm-hmm. Of course they're the same. But the reason that we don't think of them as the same has to do with going back to the histories of the production of monsters. And the core discourse of racism has been the language of dehumanization, both through biological difference, through eugenics, through understanding people as being physiologically different. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that was a big part of the project of criminology, which has had a resurgence. Even in the last several years under the Trump presidency, we've seen in the past year. But, you know, the bringing back of eugenic understandings, both for school performance and for criminal tendencies. But I think we have to interrogate this language of dehumanization, that it's so available to us. So what I would say
is... Stick with it. Just what do you mean by that?
Well, having lived through the 1980s and 1990s, you know, having been a, you know, teenager in the 80s and 90s, we weren't aware of mass incarceration. That term was not being used. But what we were aware of was a whole series of films. And it really starts in the 70s, I'd say, with Death Wish, with Dirty Harry, with a series of films that happened in the Nixon administration that were films about urban terror, that, you know, police were celebrated as the, you know, protectors and victors, and they were fighting monsters. And in many ways, it was a refighting of the Western. And they even had Fort Apache, the Bronx, is the most notorious example of this. So what we've done in our popular culture is produce monsters. Mm. And that piece of media is also very important as a counterpart that helped to naturalize this process of criminalizing whole populations. So I think we need to interrogate, not just to say people are in prison are people. Of course they are. But what the real question is, to hold the mirror back up at us. Why do we think they're not people? And I think, where did those ideas come from? And I think they come from a long history of racial discourse, both in literature, but also very important in film and media. So from Birth of a Nation.
Is it peculiarly American? I mean, do Dutch people not do that? Do Ethiopians not do that? Or, you know, any other national culture that you can think of, do they not draw these good guy, bad guy hard lines?
Well, I think that these narratives, I mean, Europe has very strong racial narratives. You know, the process of colonization, you know, the United States is a white settler colony, but of course, Europe went through its own period of imperialism and colonialism. And so you actually, I watch all different kinds of television, and you see a lot of racial tropes, particularly in countries that have had large histories of colonization and settlement, like France, for example. So I don't think the United States is unique, but I do think it's a particularly brutal white settler colony. So I think tracing the individual histories, you know, it's a different history about having been a country that was a colonizer versus a country that was colonized. And that process of creating racial others is so important to it. The U.S. is also unique in thinking about I don't want to say the United States is unique because too many people are using the word American exceptionalism. But what I'll say is that when you think about the United States and, you know, America's half century in the Cold War, so let's say from World War II, you know, through the 1980s, the United States is the world hegemon. So that's also very important. Its military power, its sense of global dominance intersects also with how its own domestic race relations. So its sense of power in the world, it shapes it. This is the biggest military power that also produces the most people in prison. So, you know, the idea of prison industrial complex is coined by Angela Davis in the late 1990s, but it was hearkening back to a longer-term discourse about, you know, the prison industrial complex was hearkening back to the military industrial complex that was used by Eisenhower in the 1950s. And that's a complex story about what the economic incentives are for building state structures.
Andrea James, I want to know how women in prison play the alienation game, the good girls, bad girls, good women, bad women, and, you know, that Donna is talking about among men.
Well, I'm not quite understanding the question, honestly, but in terms of playing an alienation game.
Creating others, good people, bad people.
Well, we've done a lot of hard work as incarcerated and formerly incarcerated women to dispel much of that, to say that, you know, particularly Donna referred earlier, thankfully, to not buying into the violent versus nonviolent descriptions that are placed on people. And certainly in our organization, we work very hard to put that to rest. You know, the labels in general, language matters, not the use of convicts, ex-convicts, inmates, former inmates, and also violent versus nonviolent offenses, because those are all things that just are just parts of this system that hold in place the ability to treat people as we treat people today, which has a very significant delineation based on race, based on class, and now this furthering of criminalization that creates this subclass of people. And so we work very hard as incarcerated and formerly incarcerated women to put an end to that. And so we just really don't engage in a conversation that talks about othering.
I'm not sure men are capable of getting over those differences between the screws and the inmates and to see each other in.
Well, you know, if you've lived in a prison, then you will recognize that the people that are working there as the correction folks or the officers are just, you know, pretty much one paycheck away from the opportunity of being on a prison bunk themselves. And so when we talk about prison abolition, we also talk about what is also necessary in the lives of the people that have taken it upon themselves for whatever reason, whether it's a paycheck, whether it's needing health insurance, whether it's needing, you know, to feed their own children. What is it that causes them to come into a place like a prison and spend so many hours of their lives working in an environment like that?
A lot of them didn't pass the police exam, right?
Well, you know, there's a lot of reasons. We have a military-industrial complex. The military-industrial complex provides jobs for people after they've you know, served this country in wars against mostly black and brown other countries. And so when you come out of service in the military, you're, you know, the majority of people that were the corrections officers in the federal prison that I was in and federal prisons across the country are former military people. And they're dealing with post-traumatic stress. They have disproportionate high incident rates of alcoholism and the illness of addiction and trauma that's untreated.
Andrea James, I hate to cut you off, but we're going to have to do this again. I can't thank you enough. Andrea James, Kaya Stern, and Donna Murch. Thanks also to Khalil Gibran Muhammad. Our show was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Becca DiGregorio, and Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our prison warden. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.